Sunday. The two top diplomats also exchanged the views on the latest reciprocal as well as international issues. Iran's foreign minister praised the ties as positive and forward-moving. The Chinese foreign minister also provided a positive assessment of the relations. Wang described Iran as a key party to the Belt and Road Initiative, stressing the importance of its participation in an upcoming meeting. He additionally shared China's perspective on the forthcoming BRICS summit in South Africa. Iran is among several countries seeking BRICS membership. The Iraqi government has ordered the formation of a committee to follow up on the U.S. assassination of the top Iranian and Iraqi commanders back in January 2020. An Iraqi lawmaker says Prime Minister Mohammad Shia al-Sudani has called for a quadrilateral committee comprised of representatives from Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Faleh al-Ghazali said the United States was the main protagonist behind the assassination of Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Deputy Commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes. The two anti-terror icons and some of their companions were killed in a U.S. drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-American President Donald Trump. Pakistani authorities have arrested two key opposition leaders in connection with an investigation into a diplomatic cipher. Detained former Premier Imran Khan claims it contained a threat from the United States to oust him from power. Our correspondent from Islamabad, Nasser Kazmi, has more in this report.
The vice chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, and party's former Secretary General, Asad Umar, have been arrested by the authorities after being accused of misusing a secret official document. Under the country's Official Secrets Act, on disclosing the contents of a diplomatic cipher for political gains, the counter-terrorism wing of Pakistan's Federal Investigation Agency registered a case against the two former federal ministers, along with ex-premier Imran Khan. Khan was sacked from power in April 2022 after he lost a no-confidence vote in parliament. Since then, he has been accusing the United States of hatching a conspiracy with the help of his political opponents and the military to remove him from power through a diplomatic cipher. Khan is currently serving 3-year jail sentence after a court found him guilty in a corruption case earlier this month. He has also been barred from taking part in politics for 5 years. Just moments before his arrest late on Saturday, the former Pakistani Foreign Minister Qureshi condemned what he called a widening crackdown on his party by the interim government. He said that his party will knock on the door of the country's top court to ensure that the elections be held on time in a free and fair manner.
It was unfortunate that PTI leaders were being arrested and then released after an announcement that they want to part ways with PTI. The caretaker Prime Minister has said that he will ensure transparent elections. I would ask him how he will do so in such an environment. I would request the Chief Justice of Pakistan and the Election Commission to take notice and ensure a level playing field for PTI.
Political analysts believe that the upcoming polls would be considered as one of the most controversial elections in the history of the country in the absence of one of Pakistan's popular political parties, the PTI.
The chief of PTI, Imran Khan, is in jail. The number two of that party, the vice chairman of PTI, is also arrested in the cipher case. So it looks that the PTI is going to be in a very disadvantageous position in the coming elections. The PTI also claims that thousands of its activists and political workers are in jail and they'll be tried in the military courts.
In the light of the possibility that the general elections may be delayed due to Election Commission of Pakistan's decision to hold new delimitations, Major political parties strongly condemned the ECP decision, warning that the unconstitutional postponement of elections could escalate into political instability and uncertainty.
According to the political commentators, if the current caretaker setup stretches beyond its constitutional tenure, a lingering period without an elected government could lead to military intervention in the cash-strapped country. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
Hundreds of Palestinians are languishing in Israeli jails under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy. For many, hunger strike is the only option to make their voices heard. 9 Palestinian inmates are now on an indefinite hunger strike in protest at their detention. 2 of the detainees have been refusing food for 18 days. A third inmate began the strike 2 weeks ago. The 6 other inmates continue their food refusal for the 11th day in a row. According to the Palestinian Prisoner Society, Israeli prison service forces have stepped up their crackdown against the hunger-striking inmates. Israel keeps holding Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. The so-called administrative detention is being enforced in defiance of international law. Wildfires are wreaking havoc in Canada's British Columbia. The devastation has forced the country to deploy its armed forces to the western province to help contain the blazes. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says the federal government has agreed to a request for assistance. The armed forces will be sent as the province has ordered over 35,000 people to leave the affected areas. Thousands more are also under evacuation alert. Authorities in British Columbia have imposed the travel restrictions to speed up the evacuation process as well as the operations to extinguish a fire. Canada is witnessing its worst wildfire season on record, with at least 1,000 active fires burning across the country. Several thousand people have rallied in the capital of Niger in support of last month's military coup. The demonstrators chanted slogans against former colonial power France and the West African Regional Bloc ECOWAS. They waved placards saying stop the military intervention and no to sanctions. Niger's military leaders say France is behind the anti-coup stance taken by ECOWAS. The bloc is considering a potential military operation to reinstate pro-Western President Mohamed Bazoum if ongoing negotiations with the coup leaders fail. ECOWAS has also imposed financial and trade restrictions on the country. The junta in Niamey has warned that an attack on Niger would not be a walk in the park. It says a transition of power back to civilian rule would not go beyond 3 years. The South African president says his country will not be forced to side with any global powers as he prepares to host a summit of BRICS, a bloc of major emerging economies.
While some of our detractors prefer overt support for their political and ideological choices, we will not be drawn into a contest between global powers. Instead, our country strives to work with all countries for global peace and development.
Ramaphosa further said that his country has resisted pressure to align with any global power or influential blocs of nations. He has made the comments ahead of the summit of BRICS leaders in Johannesburg later this week. Russia will be represented by Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, but President Vladimir Putin would address the gathering virtually. China's President Xi Jinping, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and Brazil's President Lula da Silva will attend the summit in person. The BRICS nations account for about a quarter of the world's economy. Some 40 countries, including Iran and Indonesia, have officially applied to become members. Now, China has carried out military drills around Taiwan in a stern warning to Washington following a visit by Taiwanese Vice President William Lai to the U.S. Chinese military officials said They deployed frigates, fast attack missiles, boats, fighter jets, and a number of other sophisticated weaponry as part of the drill.
The situation remains volatile around Taiwan as Chinese military has carried out joint exercises there. In a statement, the Chinese Defense Ministry said it carried out joint naval and air combat readiness patrols around the island. It said it was holding the exercises and training of naval and air forces, focusing on ship-aircraft coordination and seizing control to test the forces' actual combat capabilities. The Chinese military said the equipment deployed included destroyers, frigates, and missile boats, as well as fighters, early warning, and jamming aircraft that assembled in a predetermined area. Taiwan's defense ministry said it detected 42 Chinese aircraft and 8 ships involved in the drills around the island as of Saturday morning, and it had deployed ships and aircraft in response. The Chinese military said the maneuvers were a serious warning against Taiwan independent separatist forces colluding with external forces to provoke. Taiwan's government strongly condemned the drills. The Taiwanese defense ministry said it had the ability, determination, and confidence to ensure national security of Taiwan. The government's Mainland Affairs Council, which makes Taiwan's China policy, urged Beijing to stop what it called the intimidation and start talks, saying Taiwan's people were determined to defend themselves and would never succumb to threats of force. The council added Taiwan is a sovereign country and has a legitimate and legal rights to conduct normal diplomatic interactions with friendly countries. The drill comes against the backdrop of a visit by Taiwan's Vice President William Lai to the United States. Lai, who was a frontrunner to become Taiwan's president in elections in January, made a number of stopovers and gave speeches while on the visit.
Now, the military drills by China come as Washington has maintained its provocative approach toward Beijing in recent years. Some of those measures include the U.S. trade deal with Taiwan, American officials' diplomatic visits to the self-ruled island, and the passage of U.S. warships through the Taiwan Strait. It's believed that Washington is supporting separatist calls in Taiwan to secure its own presence there and ultimately contain Beijing.
The stopover of Taiwan's vice president to the U.S. comes as previous instances of such diplomatic visits have been the source of tensions between Beijing and Taipei, and subsequently China and the United States. That includes a visit by former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. Beijing launched joint military exercises around the island and suspended or canceled 8 official military dialogues and cooperation channels with the United States. In April this year, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen met House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on a stopover in California. Beijing authorities blasted off some angry statements, imposed sanctions against a handful of individuals or entities involved in Tsai's trip, and sent warships and planes past Taiwan. Not to mention that several U.S. delegations, comprising of American lawmakers, have traveled to the self-ruled island and met with Taiwanese officials, drawing angry reactions from Beijing. China argues that any official exchanges with Taiwan will boost calls for independence in the self-ruled island. But apart from those diplomatic exchanges, tensions over Taiwan have been escalating ever since the United States enhanced its military buildup in the South China Sea in an effort to contain Beijing. After all, China has territorial claims over the self-ruled island and has warned against any move that jeopardizes its sovereignty and territorial integrity. But regardless of those warnings, Washington has continued with its collision course with Beijing over the issue of Taiwan. The sailing of U.S. vessels through the Taiwan Strait is just to name one. That raises the question that how would the United States react if Chinese destroyers sail through areas close to U.S. borders in the North Atlantic or the North Pacific Oceans, or anywhere near the Gulf of Mexico for that matter. Given all the tensions between Washington and Beijing, what seems to be further complicating the situation is numerous provocations on the part of the United States against China. From those diplomatic visits to sailing of warships to areas close to Taiwan, all seems to be preparing the ground for full-scale confrontation between the two countries.
that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Deadly wildfires in Hawaii, which caused the biggest death toll in more than a century in the U.S. and forced thousands to evacuate from their homes, exposed the incompetence of the U.S. government. Experts say, with many local residents who survived the disaster posting videos on social media, criticizing the problematic response of local authorities and poor early warning system. Residents also criticize U.S. mainstream media reports saying this was not just a natural disaster, but also a man-made calamity. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, analysts and web users are paying attention to the horrible tragedy that Americans have suffered, as the hashtags on Sina Weibo about Hawaii wildfires have received more than 71.52 million views. Experts said the response of the U.S. government made the U.S. look unlike a developed country. A massive blaze destroyed much of the town of Lahaina on Maui over the weekend. Recently, officials confirmed 99 people have died. Hawaii Governor Josh Green told the media that the death toll would likely increase very significantly and could double or even triple over the next 10 days, according to CNN. Green said that there was very little left of Lahaina and some 1,300 people remained missing, according to CBS News. Many people, including survivors, uploaded videos to break the silence on social media networks to heavily criticize the incompetence of the government and the problematic response and early warning system. Some questioned reports by the mainstream media and said it was not a natural disaster and the death toll could be far greater than reported. Some of them said warning sirens did not sound and people received no warning about the wildfire, and they were not informed about evacuation. Some complain about the disorganized response and poor traffic system that trapped the people who wanted to escape and the rescue personnel who wanted to enter the island, and that donations have not been handed to the people in need. Some relief materials were looted as local authorities failed to restore public order. Hawaii has got a massive outdoor public safety early warning system with more than 400 sirens to remind people of threats like tsunamis, and Mo'oi has 80 of these sirens, according to the Xinhua news agency. In 2018, the system mistakenly informed the people of Hawaii state that a ballistic missile is coming due to human error. And in 2019, the system went wrong again and caused panic among locals. But this time, it failed to warn people effectively, and the state attorney has vowed to investigate, Xinhua reported recently. The Washington Post also reported residents of Lahaina, the historic former Hawaiian capital that became an inferno, have criticized what they called inadequate warnings of the sudden firestorm and said they are now being left to fend for themselves in its wake. Kai Linney, a professional surfer, according to Washington Post, said, "I feel like the citizens of this island have been called upon, maybe by a higher power, to actually help because no one else is helping." Many Chinese netizens do not understand why the powerful U.S. military force can allow Americans to feel helpless during the disaster when the Pacific Fleet is right there in Hawaii. A comment said, "Why don't U.S. military troops go to rescue their people in the disaster area?" In China, the military, police, and other professional rescue forces will respond immediately to rescue people every time when disasters occur in any location in China. Lu Xiang, an expert on U.S. studies and a research fellow at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, told the Global Times that the response of the U.S. military or National Guards this time has no comparison to their fast reaction after the Capitol Hill attack in 2021, and this means the decision makers of the country did not pay enough attention to this disaster that caused huge casualties. Lu said, "From the early warning system to the response after the disaster, the performance of the U.S. government this time just makes the U.S. look unlike a developed country." U.S. President Joe Biden was in Rebo Beach, Delaware, over the weekend and was asked during a bike ride whether he would go to Maui to assess the devastation. He replied, "We are looking at it." After a visit to the beach later that day, Biden was asked about the rising death toll on the island and replied, "No comment," according to U.S. media. The comment sparked a backlash, Fox News reported, including by former Hawaii State Representative Mark Kaniela Ng, a Democrat who now serves as National Director of the Green New Deal Network. "I campaigned for you. Now, when I lose dozens of my friends, family, and neighbors, this?" Kaniela Ng wrote in a now-deleted post. Kaniela Ng told Fox News Digital in a phone interview recently that he found Biden's remark shocking and out of character. This kind of disaster is closely related to climate change, but the Biden administration shows limited sincerity in restoring international cooperation to handle climate change issues, analysts say, adding that a disaster like the Hawaii wildfires has not received enough attention from the mainstream U.S. media, and people from other states do not seem to care much what is happening in Hawaii. Lu said, When I open the websites or apps of U.S. mainstream media like the New York Times and CNN, the headline story today is about former President Donald Trump's legal issues. And other prominent news stories are about Ukraine. But the reports about the most deadly wildfire in more than a century in the United States, while the death toll is keep updating, can only be found at the bottom. Guardian also noted, as Hawaii continues to grapple with the aftermath of the disaster, frustration at the government response to the deadliest wildfire in recent U.S. history is mounting. Residents have raised questions over officials' approach, from warnings during the inferno to aid distribution in the days since, and have argued that residents aren't getting the help they need. Jacqueline Ingram with the Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies Coalition of Hawaii, which has been providing care and supplies to residents, said, "I think people will continue to be upset. It's a slow response. The needs are enormous. More than 2,700 structures in Lahaina have been destroyed," the Hawaii governor, Josh Green, said recently, with losses mounting to an estimated $5.6 billion. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is overseeing the federal response and has 416 people on the ground.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters from all around the world. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Viewpoint. I am Beta, again here with you. And today I have the honor to have two dear guest speakers here with me, Brother Ali and Sheikh Rouhani. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome here in the studio.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for being here with me. As you know, we can just hear the whisper of secularism from every corner of the world, from illiterate people. Everyone here has their point of view in these kind of things. Like, okay, I think secularism is better because we are messing up everything with each other and so on. And these are the things that we can actually hear in conversations between the youth generation and even the older generation in our country or other countries. And at first I want you just to give me a brief a definition of secularism for our listeners, and then we're gonna go for the benefits and the bad parts of this issue. Sheikh Rouhani, I'm all ear.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, secularism is a kind of social and political movement that was developed particularly in European societies in the recent centuries. It was due to this fact that in the medieval, actually the Christian church was ruling over the nations in Europe. And because of some, we can say, misusage of religion by these religious leaders, kings, and rulers, they finally came to this conclusion that we should secularize the society. We should not give any more chance to the church, to the, let's say, religious authorities to govern the societies, to rule over the societies. So this is the kind of very brief background of this movement in the world, particularly in the modern world. So, but if you look at this issue from the Islamic perspective, since Islam is totally a different religion, categorically completely distinct religion from, what we can say, Christianity, or even Judaism. That's why from the Islamic perspective, we cannot accept, we cannot confirm secularism, which means that we should not live in according to the religious doctrines and teachings, particularly in our social and political affairs of our life. It means when it comes to the politics and let's say society and social kind of issues and affairs, we must be completely indifferent towards the modern values as well as religion. We should not rule over the people based and in accordance with religious doctrines and principles. So that's why secularism is not opposed, is not against, completely against religion. And it is not actually completely or categorically pro-religion. It tells the people that you can be either religious or not religious. But when it comes to your social affairs, political affairs, of course, you should not follow religious ideology or religious doctrines and teachings. But if you look at this issue based on this definition, we cannot accept secularism from the Islamic perspective, because Islam is completely a social religion, a comprehensive religion, which addresses all the different, let's say, dimensions of the people's life, like social, moral, economic, political, moral. All these aspects of life are addressed, are dealt with by Islam. And that's why Islam is a kind of comprehensive religion. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was a ruler. He established a kind of political system, though it was so much simple based on those conditions, on realities of that time. But of course, because of this big difference or huge difference between Islam and Christianity, we as Muslims, we can never accept secularism in the Islamic society.
Thank you, Sheikh Rouhani. But here I want to actually ask you something. As you mentioned the background of secularism, that when these Christian people saw that the church is ruling over people and actually misusing and abusing religion as a tool, they just decided to start a new way, and it was secularism, which in simple word, as you defined it, it means the separation between government and religion. Let's assume that we believe in all the principles, and we know that for sure Islam is a perfect religion, the last religion, and it paid attention to all of the aspects of everybody's individual's life and also the society. But the problem here is the Islamic government is not practicing Islam as what it is, you know. So this is the problem, and as we can see in the world, there are some countries that they are practicing secularism and they are successful. So we may assume or think in our mind that, okay, why not secularism in Islamic world?
Yeah.
What do you think, Brother Ali?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. If we want to talk about the reality of the secularism and its success, and if it is based in Islamic teachings or not, it is something that is, it's a theoretical discussion.
Yeah.
But if we want to talk about the examples and the outcome of the functions, the outcome of the functionality of a government, whether it is rooted in secular teachings or divine or Islamic teachings,
yeah,
is something else. So we should not actually intermingle these two things together.
Get it.
So we want to say that if secularism is good or bad, or is it valued, or is it important? I mean, is it appreciated, or can Islam actually digest secularism? This is something that we see that secularism have no way in Islamic teachings. If we refer to the Islamic teachings and the conduct of the Holy Prophet, the seerah of the Holy Prophet, it cannot be actually taken from the Islamic teachings. And it is quite clear that between the 11th and from 11th to 13th century, that there was a conflict between the church and the state, that the outcome of which actually shows itself in the format of this theory that is the secularism, cannot be found in Islam and Islamic teachings, because Islam has never been against the knowledge or science or the progress of the intellect, because Islam always actually values these important elements, because so even if I want to say even something beyond that, even the kind of interaction that had happened in those dark ages or middle ages, even it cannot be even based upon the pure Christian teachings, not only the Christian teachings that was there from the Jesus Christ alayhi salam. So I want to say even what had happened was a wrong, let's say, interpretation of the religion that was there. So but at the same time, in those ages that they were indulged in this interactions, that they were suffocating the progress of knowledge and the usage of wisdom, we saw the progress of the knowledge and ilm in the West and in among the Muslims. So how can we actually look at this issue that Muslims at the dark ages were flourishing? Their capabilities and capacities were actually capturing the whole world. That they became inclined towards the West and they came and took the knowledge. So does it mean that, okay, they were Muslims and they took all their knowledge from an Islamic base? But how come that they were that much empowered? So how can we digest that? How can we look at this? Because regarding to your question, you say that, okay, secular government are more progressed now. But we have seen that at those ages that they were indulged in this, I can say ignorance, I can call it.
Yeah.
Here, knowledge and science was valued and was appreciated, and the status of scholars were that high. You see, so it's not the outcome of that. So let's be back to the Islamic teachings. Let's look at the holy life of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The Holy Prophet brought and introduced a model to the world that at the same time that he was the religious leader of the Islamic Ummah, he was the political leader of the Islamic Ummah, he was the cultural leader of the Islamic Ummah, social leader of the Islamic Ummah. And he had a say. And even the imams after him, the succeeding caliphs of the Holy Prophet, had a say for every single issue in our life. So do you think that, for example, a government can be empty from these teachings? No. So how can we actually manage a government without these teachings? So if these teachings are going to be rooted in Islam, so this is Islam who is going to lead this government or to guide this system to go ahead, to give it a go. So all of these teachings are rooted in Islamic teachings. And the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, at the same time that he was a religious leader, he was thinking and he was making the final decisions, for example, how to defend the Islamic Ummah from the attack or, for example, a war, a battle that had happened at the time. So, and let me tell you even something beyond this. Not only the Holy Prophet of Islam, even the all prophets of God came to do iqama of government, that is the establishment. This concept of iqama is very common in Quran and Quranic teachings. The establishment. So this establishment of government requires lots of elements, because it doesn't come overnight. And for example, a person can say like, okay, I can do. They came down, they have been selected by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bring and to establish and divine, or let's say a religious government. So we cannot find or we cannot see any government, we cannot see any prophet or divine, let's say, messenger that didn't come without any mission, for example, to have the establishment of a government. So this government requires all of these principles and bases from a divine source. And all of them had from their own books or from the teachings that they had at their own time, and our prophet from Quran.
Yeah.
And we have lots of Quranic verses that actually supports this idea, and they have and the Holy Prophet did it. And we still believe that Islam is not something separated from, for example, state, because the state is from Islam and Islam is from state.
Again.
Right? We cannot even separate one single issue or one single element from these two, because they are all together. If, for example, Islam wants to, for example, make a decision about the society or the reflections that come to a society or to a culture of the people, they are all rooted in the Islamic teachings, and it comes from, and they will never reach or face a deadlock. And the way is always open to find a solution for every issue that happens. The model that we have brought up after 14th century, after the demise of the Holy Prophet, now in this country, shows that Islam can have solution for every issue. Look, in every issue we have a problem. If it was not the pressure of the outsiders, those who actually make lots of embargoes and pressures, the same way that they made embargoes and pressures on the Holy Prophet of Islam, they could see how this country is flourishing and is growing. Look, there are many countries in the world. None of them, for example, are under these pressures of sanctions. Why are not they? Because even they are secular governments. Why aren't they that much, let's say, grown or that much progressed?
Yeah.
But we see Iran, even under this harsh and hardest sanctions, is still growing. And if we want to compare it with the government or the countries that they didn't even tolerate one third or even one tenth of this pressure, is way ahead of those governments.
Yes.
So no, it does not mean that we have no problem inside the government. Please, I don't want. You and the respected host and all the respected listeners. It does not actually want to say that, okay, we have no problem in the country and everything is good and alhamdulillah. We have our own problems. The same way that, for example, the Holy Prophet at his own time had faced some problems from even the side of his companions, right?
The other nations also have the same problems.
Definitely.
Thank you, Brother Ali and Sheikh Rouhani, for your explanations up to here that I think me and maybe most of our listeners are convinced now that we cannot divide these two important things and values in everybody's life and society. Thank you, Brother Ali and Sheikh Rouhani, for having your opinion with me here. And I wish that be useful for you, dear listeners. Unfortunately, that was all the time we had for today's episode. I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
Standing here alone on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry. While innocent children die, Hussein has said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him. They cry out, Hussein, ya Hussein, Hussein, ya Hussein. This is Karbala. Zainab left her heart. She left her brothers in the dust. But there's much more pain to come. This is the road to Sham. Harqayya won't last long. Hussein, she won't make the journey home. She cries, ya Hussein, ya Hussein.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Canada has already recorded its worst year in terms of scorched forest land area. Reports say almost 600 wildfires are out of control in Canada. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the number of wildfires in Canada classified as out of control is approaching 600. According to a national monitor, the country is experiencing its worst wildfire season in decades. According to the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center, CIFFC, there were over 900 active wildfires in the country, with 599 of them labeled out of control. Another 104 were being held by firefighters, while 204 were considered under control. British Columbia is the worst affected province, accounting for a third of active fires, according to CIFFC statistics. The blazes have devastated 10.7 million hectares nationwide during this fire season, with over 4,200 outbreaks reported this year. The area is the largest since the monitor started compiling statistics in the 1980s. The previous record was set in 1995, when over 7 million hectares burned out in Canada. The situation has been worsening since mid-May, when the national preparedness level was raised to its highest possible point for the first time in 2023. Last year, Ottawa avoided any similar mobilization of forces to deal with forest fires. Earlier this month, smoke from Canada traveled south and blanketed parts of the U.S. in a thick haze. New York was listed as the city with the worst air pollution in the world, as fumes covered the East Coast. New York City has resumed its place atop a list of the world's most polluted cities, beating out runners-up in Vietnam and India with an unhealthy rating of 184, IQ Air reported recently. Hundreds of massive wildfires raging across several Canadian provinces have burned for nearly a week, filling the air across the eastern U.S. with a choking orange-brown haze composed of hazardous particulate matter. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the devastating blaze as the worst wildfire season they have ever had right across the country. More than 9.4 million acres have burnt, amounting to more than 15 times the 10-year average, according to the country's Minister of Emergency Preparedness, while over 125,000 people have been forced to evacuate. Trailing New York on the most polluted cities list are Hanoi and Detroit. According to the New York Times, wildfires in Western Canada are expected to create smoky conditions in the United States this week. Parts of the U.S. had unhealthy air in June from wildfires in other parts of Canada. Smoke from wildfires in Western Canada drifted across the Midwest and the Northeast of the United States, blotting out blue sky and sun and blanketing dozens of cities with unhealthy air that triggered warnings to limit the time spent outdoors. It was the second time in less than a month that the borderless impact of climate change could be felt with a breath. In June, heavy smoke from Quebec wafted into the East Coast and blew from New York City, past Washington, as far west as Minnesota. This week, as nearly 900 wildfires burnt across Canada, the smoke came from fires in the western part of the country, billowing into its southern neighbor across a wide trail. By 7 p.m. Eastern Time, nearly 70 million people in 32 states and the District of Columbia were affected by the shifting, migrating smoke, according to estimates, based on information from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and LandScan, a population database. Unfortunately, the wildfire smoke will begin to make a return to the region to start the new week, according to the National Weather Service in the Philadelphia area. Air quality alerts ranging from moderate to very unhealthy were issued by government agencies from Montana to the Dakotas and parts of other states, including Nebraska, Alabama, Tennessee, Ohio, North Carolina, and along the Northeast. Residents were advised to take precautions from limiting outdoor activities to covering up with masks. In Chicago, where the air quality deteriorated through the weekend, Mayor Brandon Johnson warned children, older residents, and those with heart or lung disease to limit outdoor activity. He said, "We are actually aware that the recent weather events prominently impacting our city this summer are the direct result of the climate crisis." Air quality advisories were also in effect across parts of Massachusetts. Governor Katie Hochul of New York issued air quality health advisories. The air quality in parts of upstate New York was expected to reach unhealthy levels for all residents, while conditions in Lower Hudson Valley, New York City, and Long Island were expected to be unhealthy only for sensitive groups. Air quality across the region was worsening, with parts of the city and state clocking more than 100 on the air quality index. Hochul said in a statement, "New Yorkers should once again prepare for smoke from the wildfires in Western Canada to impact our state's air quality this week," adding that officials were activating emergency notifications on roads and public transit systems and making sure that masks were available for distribution in counties across the state. The air quality index in Rochester started at 141 early on Monday, while Buffalo's was at 116. But those readings were improving in both cities by late afternoon. New York City officials said that conditions which are considered unhealthy for sensitive groups could persist for the initial part of the week.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Summons the Swedish and Danish chargé d'affaires in protest at the repeated acts of Quran desecration in the two European countries. A group of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are on hunger strike in protest at the regime's inhumane administrative detention policy. Also ahead, Canada deploys armed forces to tackle fast-spreading wildfires in British Columbia, which have put more than 35,000 people under evacuation order. Welcome. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign ministry summons the Swedish and Danish chargé d'affaires to protest the two countries repeatedly authorizing the desecration of the Holy Quran. The ministry strongly condemned the brazen and heinous acts. It said the Swedish and Danish governments are fully responsible for the serious consequences of such acts of blasphemy. The ministry also echoed warnings by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution against supporting the blasphemers. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei had said that backing those guilty of desecrating the Holy Quran is tantamount to going into battle array against the world of Islam. The acts of sacrilege have sparked protests and condemnations across the Muslim world, with calls for boycotting Danish and Swedish products. Iran and China have expressed satisfaction over progress in their bilateral relations in line with the 25-year strategic partnership agreement between the two countries. Iranian Foreign Minister Amir Hossein Amir Abdullahian and his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi underscored growing ties during a phone conversation on Sunday. The two top diplomats also exchanged the views on the latest reciprocal as well as international issues. Iran's foreign minister praised Thai